Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Garrett Hake in for Kristen Welker, and we begin with breaking news at the White House and on Capitol Hill. This was the scene inside the Oval Office just moments ago as President Biden, Vice President Harris, and the Big Four congressional leaders began their latest round of talks as the U.S. inches closer and closer to a potential default that could come as soon as June 1st, unless the folks in that room can come to an agreement. So how serious is the White House taking things? Well, we learned from a source just moments ago that the president will cut his upcoming G7 trip short and return to the U.S. on Sunday. President Biden ignored shouted questions about the negotiation, but says we will hear from them once talks wrap up. We expect that to happen soon, and we'll bring you any remarks as they happen live. Here's what we know about the state of negotiations at this moment to avert a potentially economic calamity. Now, as is always the case in these kinds of high-stakes talks, the devil is in the details. The White House has reportedly signaled an openness to negotiate with Republicans on several issues, including caps on government spending, reforms to help speed up some energy projects, and repurposing unspent COVID funds. But it's not nearly the size and the scope of the kind of cuts Republicans want. We've got Speaker McCarthy leaving the White House now. Let's hear what he has to say about these conversations.
Nobody should use default as a hostage. Nobody should say, unless you do this, then we default, because the consequences of default would be devastating for ordinary Americans.
We need to do everything we can to avoid default. The House Democrats have acted that way.
Directly with my team, so I found that to be productive, personally. But we've got a lot of work to do in a short amount of time. Now, I wish we had been able to be in this place 100 days ago. This is what we requested, but we are where we are. So we will work hard to make sure to try to have this to come to fruition.
Wait, will you be again?
Well, the great thing about that question is we've already have taken default off the table because the House Republicans passed a bill that raised the debt ceiling, limited our future spending, saved taxpayers money by being able to pull back unspent money and waste and actually grow our economy by making our economy stronger and helping lifting people out of poverty into work. And so those are the parameters we'll talk about. Let me give a moment to have Leader McConnell say a few words.
Let me just say what I've said since February. The President and the Speaker are the keys to the deal. I'm prepared to try to deliver as much of my conference as I can for whatever the Speaker and the President can agree to that we know will get a signature.
Speaker McConnell,
yes. Oh, it's a no-brainer. I don't think anybody in America doesn't think if you had billions of dollars sitting out there that you appropriated 2 years ago, people could not spend, and it's hardworking taxpayers' money, and the pandemic is over, you can't bring it back. It's the only place in Washington that Democrats think you shouldn't do that, but I think at the end of the day, it will be in the bill.
Mr. Speaker, when will you meet again?
Yes, sir.
A lot of Americans watching this are probably wondering, why on earth is this taking so long?
Yeah, I am too. You know, the difficult part here is I came February 1st to sit down with the president, so we wouldn't be at this day. So how could we responsibly lift the debt ceiling? Our spending is out of control. That $6 trillion extra dollars the Democrats spent brought us inflation. How could we grow our economy and make us less dependent on China and actually work together? Unfortunately, for all those thinking that, for 97 days, the president ignored us and said we couldn't meet. It wasn't until the Republicans would no longer ignore the problem and actually raise the debt ceiling, pass a bill, did we finally get a meeting. It's unfortunate we are where we are, but the good thing about it is Republicans always look to find a solution.
Mr. Speaker, yes. You said earlier this week that you were still very far apart.
We are.
You're still very far apart at this point.
Yes.
What progress was made in this meeting? If you wanted to see a deal by the end of the week,
yes.
Do you think a deal could be possible?
It is possible to get a deal by the end of the week. It's not that difficult to get to an agreement. When you think about Limit, Save, Grow, the bill we passed, we raised the debt ceiling. We cap future spendings. We grow our spending in Congress by 1% each year. That gives you trillions of dollars of savings. We bring back money that we have already appropriated from the taxpayer that wasn't spent in a pandemic. We put in work requirements that the president voted for as a senator that in Wisconsin just a couple months ago passed by 82%. It lifts people out of poverty, put them into jobs. What that does is helps our supply chain. So no longer do we borrow money from China to pay people not to work. And the only thing we're talking about are able-bodied people with no dependents. That's all you're talking about. It's already in place in certain areas. And so then we make ourselves more energy independent. We change the red tape that we can actually build things in America. So the roads we want to build, the energy projects we want to build to become energy independent. So it lowers the price to Americans, but at the same time creates more jobs and the economy gets stronger.
Are you close to this? I would think that this is asking, why this Congress is not putting any pressure on the Lebanese political class to elect a president? I'm thinking this opportunity because this is the year.
All right, come back to me when we're not talking about the debt ceiling.
With this situation still unresolved, the president, as you know, is about to head overseas for the G7. Should he stay put and not go?
Look, the president is the president of the United States. He can make his decisions of what's best and how to use it. The president has now, what has changed in this meeting is, the president changed the scope of who's all negotiating. Instead of all the four leaders, it's really he's finally taking Leader McConnell's advice that he's applied to him. The same advice you gave to President Trump that it worked out. Same advice to President Obama and others. Appoint somebody from the president's team who can work with the speaker's team to see if we could come to an agreement. That is what the decision was made in this meeting. So the structure of how we negotiate has improved. So it now gives you a better opportunity. Even though we only have a few days to get it done, had we done this back 97 days ago, we'd already have a bill passed. Yes, ma'am.
Why don't you keep slamming Republicans for cuts to veterans benefits? My understanding is the appropriation rolled out funding
that is $18 billion above fiscal year 2023 levels. Can you confirm that? And then also talk about whether the White House is negotiating in good faith. And when's your next meeting going to be? Look, great question. As you really know, is for many times the White House and the President would say Republicans are going to cut the veterans. We would say that was a lie. Today, out of appropriations, it was proven it was a lie. We actually increased spending for our veterans. It's like any other household. You prioritize where you spend your money. The real question is, how much debt is too much? We're at $32 trillion almost, 120% of our GDP. That means it's larger than our economy by 20%. This is the equivalent of your child having a credit card and they hit the limit again and again and again. And every year when your child hits the limit, all you do is increase the limit. Well, it comes to a point now that you can't afford it. So do you just increase the limit again, or do you actually take a serious thought of where you're spending your money? You're still going to fund the things that are most important to you, but you're going to eliminate the waste. Maybe you don't go to Starbucks every single day. Maybe you don't waste the money. The president just now appointed individuals. We will set. I would like to meet today, actually, and just start meeting until we get this done.
Yes.
Well, that's all up for negotiation. Inside the Republican bill, we lifted it for $1.5 trillion. I mean, when you think about it, the spending has gotten so far out of control, we already borrowed $1 trillion this year. And think about what that means to the average American. We are borrowing money. We are borrowing your future for things that are being wasted upon today. For more than $1 trillion, that means China is funding this. We need to change that behavior and make America stronger, less dependent on China, and actually curb inflation. Yes, sir. You know, look, if this is where we were in February when I first came down, I'd be very optimistic that this would get solved right away. The structure has changed, so we're in a better process. Mitch, you want to say anything else?
Well, let me. Seven of the last ten debt ceilings. Have carried something else. What the Speaker and I are advocating here is not unusual. It's more common than not. A perfect example of it is the Congressional Review Acts that we've been voting on periodically in Congress to overturn was done on a debt ceiling during the Clinton administration. So this shouldn't be this hard. Number one, we know we're not going to default. They know it. We know it. We're running out of time. And just finally, as the Speaker has pointed out, the President's agreed to designate somebody to be the lead, as I recommended to President Trump in 2019 when we faced the same situation. Do you think he wanted to negotiate with Speaker Pelosi? Of course not. I said, you have no choice.
We understand that Mr. Biden's cutting short his trip. Did you put pressure on him to do that?
Yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
Can you talk about your discussions during the meeting on the work requirements? Are you just discussing TANF changes now, or is Medicaid and SNAP requirements still on the table?
Look, I'm not going to negotiate with all of you. We know where we need to get to. We know what bill we have passed. Look, the way the founders have developed this country, which is an unbelievable country, you lend your voice to your elected officials. The House passes a bill, the Senate passes a bill, and then you go to conference. Unfortunately, the House is the only body that has passed a bill and raised the debt limit. We are now 15 days away from hitting this limit. Republicans didn't sit back and wait till Janet Yellen told us when the deadline was. We passed it long before she ever said June 1st was coming, because we didn't want to put America into jeopardy like this. And so we have worked to try to solve problems. Just as you looked at Title 42 being lifted on the border, we didn't ignore the problem, like the White House. We actually put a border control bill out there so we can secure our borders. And what happened this weekend? A person on the terrorist watch list from Afghanistan was just coming across this border. Why? You know, we caught more people in the month of February on the terrorist watch list than we caught the entire time of the last administration. You can't keep ignoring problems. You got to find solutions. And that's what the Republicans in the House have done. Yes, ma'am. Look, I think America is the number one economy in the world. And when we get done with this negotiations, America's economy is going to be stronger, because we're going to make the American economy stronger by putting more people back to work, lifting them out of poverty, lowering our energy costs, and more importantly, curving our spending that the runaway. So as the world looks around and look back at America, said they were spending too much, they won't be able to say that when we're done. Thank you all very much. Have a good day.
Our staff meeting today.
All right, we're back now after listening to the two Republican congressional leaders break down what happened in this White House meeting on the White House grounds. I'm joined now by NBC News White House correspondent Monica Alba here on set, who's been watching this with me, and NBC's Sahil Kapoor is on Capitol Hill. And Monica, I'll start with you. I mean, we just watched these two Republican leaders walk out of the Oval Office and describe the contours of a negotiation here. It seemed like they kind of put the White House on the back foot. They said that there'd be somebody appointed to take over these negotiations directly with Kevin McCarthy. Do we know who that person is yet, or how the White House views what just happened in this last hour?
We don't know who that person is, but I think that's going to be a critical part of all of this. And the fact that you had Speaker McCarthy saying, look, for the first time in his view, the president is taking our advice. It was Leader McConnell who came in and said, this is something that worked in the past administration. You should maybe take a look at this now. We haven't at all heard from the White House yet on how they viewed this meeting, whether it was productive, whether they felt like that is something that they're going to do going forward. But we do know that the president is going to have to delegate some other people to play a key role here.
Now we've got the Democrats at the microphone. Here's Chuck Schumer.
But we also agree that we need to pass a bipartisan bill with bipartisan support in both chambers. I asked Speaker McCarthy, does he agree with that? And he said, yes. And his bill, of course, is not a bipartisan bill. And so the bottom line is that we all came to agreement that we were going to continue discussions in the way that I believe Speaker McCarthy described, which was agreed to by all of us in the room together. And hopefully we can come to an agreement. We don't have much time, but default is just the worst alternative. And having a bipartisan bill in both chambers is the only way we're going to avoid default. Hakeem and I are committed to trying to get that bipartisan bill done.
It was a positive meeting. I thank the president for once again convening us. It was an open and an honest, but a very cordial discussion. We all agreed that the only path forward is to reach a bipartisan agreement anchored in common ground. We all agreed that default is not an acceptable option and must be avoided. And we all agreed that over the next few weeks, we have to proceed with the fierce urgency of now in order to make sure we can reach that bipartisan, common sense, common ground agreement so that we can protect the health, the safety, and the economic well-being of the American people.
A few questions. Yes, yes. Yeah, we're not going to get into negotiations out here. We have to come to common ground. That's the only way this has ever gotten done. It has never gotten done with one party saying, you have to do it my way. You have to get both parties in both houses together. Yes.
How do you define a common ground?
Well, you'll know it when you see it, and that what that means is that we'll not sacrifice our values. They'll probably not sacrifice their values, but we'll have to come together on something that can avoid default. Default is a disaster. Full stop. And everyone understood that in the room. I was glad to see that everyone understood what a disaster default was.
Would you say that you're closer to a deal today than you were a week ago? You said it was productive.
Yes, I think it was, as the leader said, it was a much more cordial meeting. There were honest and real discussions about differences that we have on a whole variety of issues. But it was all respectful, and that was a good sign as well. Okay?
Mr.
Do you want to say one thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
It was...
Well, President Biden has done an extraordinary job of bringing us together last week, setting in motion staff discussions that have been positive and productive over the last several days, and then bringing us back together to have another positive discussion with a clear path forward in terms of reaching an agreement, because default is not an option. Everyone agreed that that was the case. A default would be a disaster for the American people. It would trigger a job-killing recession. Default would crash the stock market and hurt the retirement security for millions of older Americans. And a default would dramatically increase costs on people all across the country. And it was a very positive development that everyone agrees. We're going to work with the fierce urgency of now over the next week or two, reach an agreement, avoid any default, and continue our efforts to be there for everyday Americans.
The thing that, you'll get the last question, but one thing I want to say, what gave me the most hope, and there were a bunch of things, is that everyone, including the speaker, agreed we need to be bipartisan. The idea of having a partisan bill we knew would get us nowhere, and everyone freely admitted that in the room. Last question.
Clarifying something that McCarthy said, he said the president appointees or negotiators. What does that mean? Is it new staff? Are you getting
no? Well,
okay, who are those people?
I'll let the president talk about that. But the bottom line is the bipartisan negotiations that we've had are going to continue, but there'll be a few additional players added to those. Thank you, everybody.
Same thing. All right. So I'm back with Monica Alba now, and I'm just struck, Mon, by the fact that the White House is letting everyone else characterize what was just discussed, even down to the point that what Chuck Schumer said about the negotiations going forward is not the same as what the Republicans were saying going forward. We don't really know what's happening right now, but I do think we heard one really clear shift from the Democrats there, that a bipartisan bill is what's coming. The idea of no negotiations, a clean debt ceiling lift seems to be gone now for the White House.
I think so. And it was the president who had said this for weeks, and he had said he didn't even want to negotiate. Then today there was this whole conversation about the semantics of if this isn't negotiating, what is it? Obviously, that's what this is. These negotiations have at least come, though, to a place of some incremental progress. I think that's the big takeaway from today. Both sides calling this at least productive, at least charting a path forward and identifying, again, ways they can get this done. Everybody agreeing that default is not an option. Also, just in terms of the tone in the meeting, the fact that this was a little bit more cordial, the fact that it sounds like there was more of an exchange of ideas and a little bit less of the personal fireworks that we saw in the meeting last week. But the backdrop to all of this, Garrett, is the fact that the president is leaving tomorrow for Japan, but he has now, we can report, cut his trip short. That is the backdrop to all of this, because it was Speaker McCarthy who sort of said, if I'm the president, I don't think I should be gone for the entirety of this time. And now that is what the president is doing. He's going to come back early to deal with this. But in the interim, there are going to be these other key players. We just saw Chuck Schumer say, introduced to the conversation. That's a bit of a new element, something we need to learn a little bit more about. But at least it does seem both sides have agreed on how to proceed and keep the conversations going in a bipartisan fashion.
I'm also struck by the difference between the tone that the president and the White House more broadly have taken about sort of like, this is fine, the president making comments about it over the weekend while riding his bike, that this was all going to get handled, between then and now, with this abrupt cancellation of the second part of the G7 trip. And I should tell folks at home, for our audience, we had the deputy director of the National Economic Council booked on this program, abruptly canceled during those remarks. It seems like the White House has been back-footed by the urgency of where they are right now on a negotiation where they've had the same data that we've had in public this whole time.
For months, and they've been planning this trip for even longer than that, these key summits. So absolutely, you're right to say that the pressure here clearly is something that triggered this decision to cut the trip short. But also, I think it's a White House that is going to come out and say this is because the president is prioritizing this issue over everything else. And they're going to point that to the fact that the Quad Summit and the meeting with the leaders of Australia, Japan, and India that was going to take place in Australia is now going to essentially take place in Japan, and that they can kind of be flexible and have these key meetings on the world stage while monitoring everything that's happening back home. But I do think the president, who did have a way more optimistic view of all of this over the weekend, I don't think actually that's going to change. He's still going to come out here and probably say, look, I wanted both sides to get closer today in this meeting. That is what happened. We're going to continue to proceed. I'm going to go on this trip. I'm going to come back early. We're still going to get it done by June 1st. And we're going to hear from the president, we believe, in the next hour or so at a different event, where that's likely what he will say. But it did sound a little bit different in terms of everybody at least agreeing they have a bit of a clearer sense of what needs to happen next. The bigger thing is, can they get it done in the very short amount of time they have to hash out this deal?
He has called himself a congenital optimist. We'll see if that optimism remains when we hear from the president a little bit later. Monica Alba, thank you for your reporting and your analysis on this. I want to bring in my colleague on Capitol Hill, Sahil Kapoor. Sahil, we've been following this together for months now. You speak as fluent McCarthy as anybody. I'm curious what you heard from the speaker there that sounded new. I mean, his tone of frustration about how long this has gone on remained the same. But what did you hear from him that either gives you optimism or, you know, caused you some concern that we might be farther from where we need to be on getting this done by June 1st?
Well, Garrett, from McCarthy, there's still a lot of apprehension and uncertainty. But for the first time, I heard seeds of hope in his comments about averting default in time. He talked about how the structure of negotiations has improved. That is a positive sign from his perspective. He said he wishes that they were at this place 100 days ago. Clearly, this place is better, in his view, than any place that they had been some time earlier. It was also a good sign, I think, that McCarthy and Chuck Schumer declined to discuss the details of negotiations. You know, it's always a bad sign, as you know, as well as anyone else, Garrett, that when they talk about the details of what they're negotiating, then they're not actually close to a deal. They weren't doing that. Chuck Schumer, as well, for his part, insisted again and again that this has to be a bipartisan bill. That's not entirely new for him. He has been saying that, but he did give a little bit more than he has in the past. And instead of kind of criticizing McCarthy as someone who is jonesing for default, who is, you know, egging the country on to default, he didn't do that. So I think between both of those comments, you can see a path forward. McCarthy also said, and I was struck by this, quote, "It is possible to get a deal by the end of the week." That sounds very optimistic, although the timeline we're looking at, 16 days from now until the X date, and the time it takes to get anything through the Senate in particular, right, they probably need to get at least an agreement in principle, the contours of this sorted out by the end of this week if they want a strong chance of passing it through both chambers by June 1st, Garrett.
Right, right. I mean, you can't pass a deal, right? I mean, getting a deal by the weekend is one thing. Turning it into legislative language and a bill that people support is something else altogether. Sahil, I'm glad you mentioned Schumer, because I had the opposite reaction, quite frankly. I thought it was as candid as Schumer and Jeffries have been about the idea that they're not going to get a clean debt ceiling lift. You heard them say this is going to take a bipartisan bill. That's not the language they've been using up until now. Do you think some of that messaging is directed at their Democratic caucus here? That, all right, guys, like, this is a different game now.
I think that's absolutely right. I think a lot of Democrats were caught flat-footed when Kevin McCarthy passed that bill through the House. A lot of Democrats were betting on the fact that McCarthy would not be able to get a bill through with only Republican votes and would have no hand to play. McCarthy did prove them wrong in that element, and it changed the trajectory of this. This meeting, for the first time, seems to have produced this recognition among Democratic leaders as well, that there's going to have to be some give on their side. Now, they're likely to structure this, Garrett, as a parallel negotiation that involves some budgetary components. So Democrats can come out of this saying, we held to our red line, we didn't negotiate on the debt limit, we negotiated on the budget. That's what they're likely to say. Republicans are likely to say, we got the concessions, the White House finally backed down, they caved, and they gave us XYZ. It seems like that is going to be the path to a deal. There is still a long way to go, as you heard from everybody, but I do think the nearing deadline, the nearing X date, the cliff getting closer and closer, has pushed everyone to this place. One other notable thing, Garrett, about Schumer and Jeffries talking about the bipartisan aspect, that pretty much rules their discharge petition out. Tomorrow is the day where they can start collecting signatures on that so-called discharge petition, which for the uninitiated is this mechanism where mm-hmm. they can go around Kevin McCarthy and pass a clean debt limit bill. What I heard there was a recognition that they're not going to get that clean debt limit bill. There's going to have to be some give on their side, even if they will describe it as a negotiation on the budget.
No, it's such a good point. I mean, that and the 14th Amendment conversation presumably goes away a little bit here, too. I mean, you certainly hear the congressional leaders, move around that. Biden's never particularly embraced it, but it looks like we won't be seeing him do that now. All right. Sahil Kapoor, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for your analysis on this. And we've got a whole lot more to chew on this topic and a good person to chew on it with. I'm joined now by Democratic Congressman Jared Golden from Maine. I don't know how much you were able to hear of this news conference afterwards, but I wonder just what your general reaction is, at least to the idea that we heard, from Speaker McCarthy, at least, that he thinks it's a good sign of progress that we've now got a smaller negotiation, perhaps, and maybe now things can move forward towards breaking this impasse.
Well, I was able to listen in, and of course I agreed to come on the show last week not knowing that they're meeting at the White House today. But what I would say to folks back home is don't pay attention to what gets said at the microphone following a meeting like that over the next 10 or 15 minutes or several hours. Watch what happens over the next 48 hours. Who's meeting with who, and it sounds like everyone has agreed that staff and others are going to be carrying on these conversations. That's no different than last week. People came out after the meeting last week. They postured. They said things. Suggested that talks didn't go all that well, but almost immediately we saw progress and understood that the White House and the Speaker's offices were engaged in talks the very next day.
It's hard for me to imagine a coalition in the House that could pass a bipartisan bill on this that doesn't include you. I'm curious what you think this final deal might look like. How big, how small, what seems like it might be on the table for a bill that will, presumably be written in the Speaker's office, but will need Democratic votes like yours to get to President Biden's desk.
Well, the one thing that I really want to stress is that myself and the Blue Dog Caucus that I am co-chairing has been calling for these negotiations since February 1st. Mm-hmm. We sent a letter to the president. I think we had a very clear message. Mm-hmm. It's been obvious since the last election that this was going to require a deal, either raising the debt ceiling or getting a spending package agreed to. The voters gave us a divided Congress where the Republicans now have control of the House. The Senate is controlled by Democrats. I think that this has been a foregone conclusion all along. Yeah. I know that there's a lot of hype and all that stuff around it. But to us, we saw what was going to be necessary from the very beginning. And as a result, said, let's just cut to the chase. Let's skip the standoff. And let's talk real about our nation's budget. So something that Blue Dogs stand for and that I believe is important is talking about reducing our budget deficit. And from the perspective of Democrats, at a time when we spent more on the interest on our debt in the last budget than we did on transportation, education, and veterans combined, when we can look down the road and see that the same, not only is that going to remain true, but actually grow to a point where almost we're paying more than our entire domestic agenda at this current time. This is something Democrats have to take seriously because many of the things that we stand for and care about, that our constituents care about, are going to get squeezed out by these budget deficits if we don't take it seriously. I would say that I think we'd be in a stronger negotiating position right now if we had led the charge in saying, let's sit down and negotiate about this starting now back in February.
Just a quick aside for our viewers. I want to let you know, Kevin McCarthy is speaking again now at the Capitol. We're monitoring that. We're going to see if he says anything different than what he said at the White House. But our team is on top of that. We'll bring that to you as necessary in terms of the news value of what the speaker might say at his second bite at the apple here. And Congressman, I mean, even to that point, you get the speaker out here talking about this again. You talked about the idea that it might have been better for Democrats to lead on this. Are you satisfied with the urgency with which the White House and Democratic leadership have approached this issue, that we're at a point now where the president's canceling elements of a key forward trip 2 weeks beforehand because we're still not there?
I've been disappointed with the way they've handled it up until the most, you know, the last week, mm-hmm. essentially. Writing a letter to the president on February 1st saying we need to negotiate. I put out a kind of mini proposal to say, well, here's some ideas to kickstart talks. I did that in early April. Of course, just a few weeks ago when Speaker McCarthy put their bill on the floor, the very first statement I made after that vote, joined by Congresswoman Perez and Congresswoman Peltola, three Democrats from rural areas, from districts that Donald Trump won in, you know, in previous elections, we said it's time to sit down and commence these talks. So it's good to see the progress that's taking place now. Of course, there's urgency as we're running up against a potential deadline. Of course, we don't know if June 1 really is the X date or not, but it's good to see the urgency. It didn't have to be this way.
You certainly don't want to see it come down to that day. We know that to be a sure thing.
Sure.
I want to ask you, one of the elements that seems to have come up in this discussion over the last couple of days is it's this focus on work requirements, changing work requirements for some of these various government assistance programs, whether it be for food stamps, potentially Medicaid has been discussed. Speaker McCarthy has said it's a red line for him that has to be in there. Some Democrats have said it's a red line that these work requirements can't be touched. I wonder where you fall on that issue, again, representing a rural district where these benefits are really important.
Well, to date, I've been focused on the process and a desire to get Democratic leadership to acknowledge what was going to happen and how can we position ourselves for these negotiations from the strongest position possible. And like I said, I think we're in a weaker position because the no negotiating stance was always
It
was not tenable.
And
now we're in it. And that's splitting hairs, whether we're negotiating on the debt ceiling or not. I think everyone knows what is going on. Here's the point I want to make. From a fiscal stability standpoint, yes, we need to reduce our deficit, but we can't let it be defined as just cuts to important programs. We can talk about taxes on the wealthiest Americans in this country, rolling back portions of the 2017 tax cut, which largely benefited a lot of very wealthy households and individuals. We can dedicate that to paying off this nascent debt, to getting a handle on our budget deficit.
Should Democrats be insisting
on put that on the table?
Should Democrats be insisting on having a tax part of this debate? Like, say to Republicans, if you're really that serious about the debt and deficits, you have to talk about this part of it too.
I would say to folks back home is anyone who claims that they're serious about fiscal responsibility has got to be willing to acknowledge that it is raising revenues, it is making sure that our spending is thoughtful and well-targeted, not wasteful, and it is being open to things like caps and cuts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's going to require that we respond to emergencies like we did with COVID, and Congress responded to that in a very strong bipartisan way. But now's a good time to talk about getting our fiscal house in order. But you cannot cut your way out of our budget deficit or out of the debt that we have, and you cannot tax your way out of it. It's got to be an all-of-the-above approach.
You talk about what you say to folks back home. What do folks back home say to you about this issue? I asked that because we had a story on NBCNews.com, I guess yesterday, about the idea that most people out in the country are not paying close attention to this issue, that they kind of understand there's this theoretical major problem here, both with the debt broadly and the debt ceiling specifically. But it seems like just another one of those Washington things that people get hyped over, but then it never really becomes an issue. What do you hear from your constituents on this?
In general, I think I hear that they're tired of the games. This looks like political, brinksmanship. It looks like partisan fighting. It looks like a lack of leadership coming out of Washington. And really what I think my constituents have largely said to me is we're sending you down there to get the job done for the country. And we could skip all of the fighting here. The standoff, like I said, would have been better had these negotiations started many months ago. Nevertheless, here we are now. I'm not interested in trying to pick at what may or may not be agreed to by the president and Speaker McCarthy at this point, because we got to wait and see what comes out of it, and then each of us decide what we can and can't support. But you know, again, good that they're negotiating in earnest at this point in time.
I've found the only people more motivated by deadlines than journalists have been members of Congress, and this just proves that one more time. Jared Golden, thank you for coming in and talking about this today on a very busy breaking news day. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a quick break now with much more Meet the Press Now, a lot to discuss ahead.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and Today Show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. And just as I said about Speaker McCarthy, this is now a live picture of Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, back at the Capitol answering some questions from the Capitol press corps now. We're going to monitor this and see if we get any news that's different from what we heard at the White House, as we still also await hearing from the president for the first time after this apparently pretty newsy meeting today. Now, I'm joined by our panel for today. White House correspondent for Politico and Playbook co-author Eugene Daniels is here. Democratic strategist Margie O'Meara is here. And former Republican Governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman. She's also the current co-chair of the Forward Party. I want to start, Eugene, with what we just saw at the White House. I am so struck by the fact that you had, coming out of this meeting, two Republicans standing on President Biden's lawn, basically, describing his position in a debt ceiling conversation. The White House seems back-footed by all this. What's going on inside the West Wing right now to regain control of this narrative?
Yeah, one, describing his position, but also announcing eventually that he's going to have negotiators while he's in Japan and who they're going to be. We're going to see Steve Ricchetti, one of his counselors, and also Shalanda Young. That's according to Kevin McCarthy. Yeah. The White House has said nothing about that. I will say this White House doesn't seem to care about that, right? We have seen over and over in the last 2.5 years, different leaders from around the world come in, and they have their own readout of the conversation, and the White House sends their, you know, four paragraph readout and kind of leaves it at that. Mm-hmm. And they are fine doing that. What you're going to continue to hear from folks, and I have already heard, we're not going to negotiate with you guys. We're going to negotiate behind closed doors, so we're not going to do it. But it does make them look bad, mm-hmm. right? Like, you have the four leaders coming out and saying different things and breaking the White House's news. It doesn't look great.
Margie, we had the president cancel the second half of this foreign trip just as basically as they were in this meeting is when the news came out. I mean, we were supposed to have someone from the NEC on to talk about the White House's policy on debt and the deficit coming out of this. What would be your advice to them to regain control of this issue that seems to have hijacked what Joe Biden would like to be talking about right now, this big foreign trip, the pivot to Asia, which we have heard described since the Obama administration?
Look, I think what's important is that we avoid defaults. That's what all the polls show, that it's polls and focus groups. People don't say, oh, I wish somebody would say X, Y, and Z on the lawn versus the Capitol. That's mm-hmm. not what voters mm-hmm. say in focus groups. What we saw in a poll is that a majority say the worst thing that could happen is we have to cut things that are part of the Republican plan, cutting Medicaid, cutting, you know, support checks for veterans. The thing that they're least worried about, that they would see as the least bad thing, is raising the debt limit. So people want to see this resolved, and anything that could forward, you know, furthers that goal, I think voters would find.
Does Joe Biden get positive credit from voters if they avoid default, or is this purely a don't lose this game situation if you're the White House?
Well, I think that's a fair question, right? Because it's not something that necessarily everyone's following every right. twist and turn. So there are very serious consequences if we go into default, and there may not be a similar, like, hooray if we avoid it, right? And that's true no matter matter who the players are in every kind of situation that we've had like this. That's always been true. Mm-hmm.
Christine, something that I feel like the Forward Party would like, you heard the Democratic leaders come out and say, we're going to do this in a bipartisan way. They're really hammering the idea that the solution to this is bipartisan. Is that the way to make people in the rest of the country whose eyes have glazed over at this debate at least reconnect with it in some way and root for a resolution, if not, you know, the policy outcome of their choice?
They're already rooting for a resolution. I mean,
are they rooting at all? I mean,
when they think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not their number one topic on most people's list because they've got to worry about day-to-day issues that are facing them. But they're tired. This is exactly what is wrong with our political system. They're tired of these two parties coming out and looking for talking points and,
yeah.
and just stopping, refusing to agree on anything so they can carry something along a little bit longer. And this has real consequences for our country. That's what Forward is trying to work to ensure that we get the kind of representatives who are free from the party dictates and they can vote their conscience and vote what's best for the people they represent.
And we just heard some of that from Jared Golden, who I feel like is one of those guys right in the middle, exactly the kind of space you're talking about. This is Meet the Press Now. I think we're contractually obligated on Tuesdays to talk about the elections that are happening around the country. So I want to talk about the Kentucky governor's primary, the Republican primary that's happening today. And Christine, I'll start with you. We saw Ron DeSantis make a late entry into this race, endorsing Kelly Kraft at the last minute.
Right.
She is arguably the Trumpier candidate, but not the one that Donald Trump has endorsed.
Right.
Why do this if you're Ron DeSantis? Why inject yourself into this race at the last minute?
There are a lot of things that Ron DeSantis is doing that I don't understand. This would be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't get why he wants to have a horse in this race. But I think maybe he's feeling the pressure because he seems to be slipping in the polls to show that he's active and to show that he does have candidates. And because she is the Trumpier and had Trump, you know, she endorsed Trump before and the two of them are fighting over who's the real Trump candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I think he just thinks this is a place he should play.
Eugene, the former president loves to keep track of this metric, right? His endorsees that win. How seriously should sort of 2024 presidential watchers be caring about what's happening in the bluegrass state over the next 24 hours?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at it to try to figure out what's going to happen in the primary, probably not much, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot is going to change over the next year and a half, or the next year and some change. We haven't even seen DeSantis actually say that he's going to run. There are a lot of other maybe candidates that are walking around. I think what's really fascinating is that, like you said, DeSantis jumping in, he's just trying to make sure that he's a national player, right?
He's in the conversation.
Right. He wants to be in the conversation. Whether or not his candidate actually wins the primary doesn't actually matter. What I have heard from donors, from Republican strategists who've been looking for a campaign to jump on, is that they have wanted to see him step up mm-hmm. into the national spotlight and not just be talking about kind of the culture wars, right? This is him talking about actual policies and talking about candidates that he thinks he can help push over the finish line.
But that's what Kraft's ads are all about, the culture
yep.
wars. I don't know if you saw Pat Kraft's ad, and she has people literally parachuting into a school and singing CRT instead of ABCs. I mean, it is like cartoonishly ridiculous. And it
mm-hmm.
is maybe in that respect, it is like DeSantis and a culture war. Maybe that makes a good fit for them. Cameron has been up in all the polls.
Yeah.
So we'll see. It's a closed
right.
primary, which means that maybe that benefits the more Trumpy candidate. At the same time, Trump's record in primaries has not been very good either. So,
if you're Governor Beshear, are you pleased that Ron DeSantis got in the race? Does nationalizing the race in some way help you, or does it hurt you as the popular Democratic governor of a very red state?
It actually helps you if you're a Democratic governor in a red state. We worked with Laura Kelly in Kansas, who is a Democratic
mm-hmm.
governor, won
is
twice.
Still the Democratic
won
governor.
Won twice, in, but was you know where you have the national, you have the sort of nationalization of what Republicans are talking about, and she could just focus on cutting taxes in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that people really responded to her personally. What she'd done for Kansas is very similar to what Bashir's been doing in Kentucky.
Bashir is one of the most popular governors.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's
polling
like
at 63%
or something. Yeah.
So it's going to make it a very interesting race to see how well the Republican side does against him.
Yeah. And, for Democrats, for those Democratic governors like Beshear, they can just sit back and let Republicans look messy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That is what you hear from folks in the White House about what the 2024 race is going to look like for President Biden. They're just kind of going to let these governors and these presidents and vice presidents that they already have, these incumbents, look presidential and look like governors and have primaries in the Republican side look messy. And that is what they're hoping to have, because then you have both voters looking for, okay, there's a lot of chaos on this side. Maybe the Democrats.
Yeah, you don't need to hope. It happens all on its own.
To that end, I want to play a bite from Ron DeSantis talking about his abortion comments and the abortion ban that was signed into law in Florida, because this is another one where Democrats are very happy to let Republicans just keep talking about this issue. Let's hear from Ron DeSantis.
I think that as a Florida resident, you know, he didn't give an answer about would you have signed the heartbeat bill that Florida did? They had all the exceptions that people talk about. The legislature put it in. I signed the bill. I was proud to do it. He won't answer whether he would sign it or not.
Now, the he that's being referenced there is Donald Trump, which is interesting in its own right that he won't use Donald Trump's name. But here you see Ron DeSantis trying to stake a claim to this 6-week abortion ban that he signed in Florida that Donald Trump cannot run away from fast enough. I'm curious how you guys think that issue is going to play in that primary, because you are seeing two very different strategies.
They're both bad in a general election audience. Yes. I mean, you know, you either are saying whatever kind of word salad that Trump said during the town hall, which, you know, to DeSantis' credit, like it was not very coherent. And what DeSantis' position is, which is so not what the general election position is, it's barely a Republican primary position. I mean, it's a single digit position in the country to have such an extreme abortion ban on nearly all abortions before most women know they're pregnant. That's not what voters want. That's why you see Trump and others and North Carolina legislature, all these places, like, trying to kind of pretend that this is not really their position and finding some way to kind of circumvent what their unpopular position is.
But they're about to, North Carolina, they're about to override the veto, the governor's veto, when you've got 62% of that state that says that abortion should be legal in most instances.
A state that the Biden campaign just made clear they want to compete in. I don't think this is a coincidence that timing is what it has been. Folks, thank you very much. We could do an hour on this. We really should, but we got to leave it there. Thank you all. And after the break, tech execs testify before Congress as lawmakers grapple with reining in a potentially dangerous AI arms race. Key moments from those hearings are next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Congress held dueling hearings on artificial intelligence this morning as Washington grapples with how to regulate the emerging technology. A Senate Homeland Security Committee focused on AI's use in government agencies, while the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy and Technology spoke to industry leaders on the best ways to oversee and regulate the broader industry. Lawmakers expressed their desire to get ahead on AI and address the potential dangers the technology poses.
Congress has a choice now. We had the same choice when we faced social media. We failed to seize that moment.
So I've been keeping a little list here of the potential downsides or harms, risks of generative AI. Loss of jobs, invasion of privacy, personal privacy, on a scale we've never before seen. Manipulation of personal behavior, manipulation of personal opinions, and potentially the degradation of free elections in America.
Now, for their part, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, whose company is behind ChatGPT, which is now the fastest growing app of all time, and IBM's Christina Montgomery were forthcoming about their fears around AI, pointing to those concerns as reasons they actually want regulation from the government.
I think if this technology goes wrong, it can go quite wrong. And we want to be vocal about that. We want to work with the government to prevent that from happening.
That's why we're here advocating for precision regulatory approach. So we think that AI should be regulated at the point of risk, essentially. And that's the point at which technology meets society.
Following his testimony, Mr. Altman also met with House members to discuss AI. Earlier this afternoon, I spoke with one of the congressmen who attended that meeting, Republican Congressman Jay Obernolte, the only member of Congress to actually have a degree in AI. You can find that entire conversation on our website. And while you're there, be sure to check out the newest episode of Meet the Press Reports. It takes a deep dive into the power of AI, featuring exclusive interviews and analysis. It's available to stream on demand right now via Peacock or YouTube. And still to come, President Zelensky shores up support from his European allies as Ukraine's military gains ground in the east and prepares a major counteroffensive. The latest developments are next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Overnight, Kyiv was once again the target of a massive Russian missile attack. The eighth time this month, the capital city was targeted. As you can see in this video, bright flashes of light could be seen in Kyiv as Russia launched its latest wave of attacks. Ukraine's Air Force says the country's air defenses were able to intercept all 18 missiles, including six hypersonic missiles. According to Kyiv's mayor, several cars and buildings were damaged as a result of the intercepts, and at least three people were injured as a result of the falling debris. Now, this attack comes as President Zelensky wraps up his blitz across Europe, where he met with multiple European leaders as he tries to secure more military aid ahead of Ukraine's planned spring counteroffensive. Joining me now is Ukrainian Member of Parliament Kira Rudik. And Kira, what's your reaction to this latest strike? What have you been hearing from people on the ground in Kyiv about the really successful defense of the city overnight?
Hello, Gareth. Thank you so much for having me. Well, first of all, I can tell you one thing. Last night was really, really scary. We are so, so grateful that nobody was hurt to death. And we are so, so grateful that right now we are a living proof that our air defense systems are able to take down all kinds of missiles that Russia can send our way. It's a fantastic proof of that we can put the weapons and supplies that all our allies send us to a good use, because it literally saves life, because we did not know if we are going to go through this night. Mm-hmm. It was really fighting real, like in a worst case, Star Wars in our skies. Yeah. So make sure that we would not experience similar things again. We need fighter jets because they will add additional layer of protection to our skies and to our peaceful cities.
Talk to me more about that, because that's something that President Zelensky has been saying as he's been traveling across Europe, the idea of creating a jet coalition. Why do you think the West has been so reluctant to send fighter aircraft to Ukraine? And explain why you need more jets based on than what Ukraine's Air Force already has.
Well, every time we are asking for a new kinds of weapons or a new systems of weapons, there is a hesitance because it can be taken as an escalation mm-hmm. by Russia. However, we absolutely do not believe that, because Russia already committing all kinds of war crimes on our territories, launching terrorist attacks almost every single night. Fighter jets is not only a very important tool for us for the counteroffensive that is upcoming, but it is also an essential additional layer of protection to hold Ukraine that is not actively fighting in the war, to the peaceful people in their homes. Can you imagine how it feels when every single night when you're going to bed, you do not know if you're going to wake up in the morning? But this is what we feel. And though our air defense systems work right now at the 100% capacity, we still understand that they do not guarantee us that we will be safe. This is why we need fighter jets. It is not because we like fighter jets or we want fighter jets. It is a matter of life and death for us. And this is why we keep asking for them to be sent to Ukraine so we can defend ourselves and make sure that we stay alive.
Now, that's not something that can be kind of delivered off the back of a truck and turned around and used in this spring offensive. How critical are these jets? Is air power in general going to be for this spring offensive we've now heard so much about?
Well, if you think about any kind of major war, even Second World War, you would think that it would be impossible to win it without domination in the air. And this is what we are trying to build here, being able to dominate in the air, to both defend our troops and also people who are not actively fighting. We understand that it's a long process to deliver fighter jets to Ukraine, but we will not be able to finalize the victory, to push as hard as we need without them. And it is not something new that we are talking about. We have been talking about it since the day one of the full-scale invasion, that to win the war, we would need our ability to push Russia out of the sky.
Ms. Rudik, I only have about 30 seconds left, but I want to ask you, China's special representative is in Ukraine today. The Chinese are saying they want to negotiate a political settlement. What do you want to see come out of that meeting? Is it too early to be talking a political settlement with China or anybody else?
Whoever is trying to be in between this, we are saying one thing. While Russian soldiers are on our territory, there is no negotiation. We need to regain our sovereignty, our independence, and then we can talk.
All right. Kira Rudik, Ukrainian MP, thank you so much for coming on with us, and please do stay safe.
Thank you, and glory to Ukraine.
Thank you all for being with us this hour. Chuck will be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson